Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager.
And you did read the title right. This is our necrophilia episode. So we want to throw out just a couple of quick disclaimers before we move forward. Not everything in this episode is going to deal with human necrophilia, but a lot of it does. So there is some of the information we're covering here is going to be a little sexual in nature.
Certainly graphic
and at least a little disturbing. Now we're not going to go all in on the details. You know, we're going to keep it reasonable here, but still, we're just going to throw that disclaimer out there. So proceed, maybe not at your own risk, but hey, you know, if this is not your thing, then maybe you should just skip to the next episode.
Yeah, and I just want to also acknowledge that, you know, we didn't choose this solely to be gross, but that, like, there's, as you will find throughout this episode, there's been a ton of research into it. But also that human beings are naturally fascinated by the concept of necrophilia. And it seems to be, maybe we'll get to the heart of this by the end of the episode, but because it's pretty much the ultimate transgression, because you know that almost anybody that you pose this to is going to be horrified by it.
Yeah.
Unless they're like secret cults of necrophiles that, you know, are able to talk about it with one another, it's pretty much a solitary habit in human beings.
Yeah, and it occupies such a weird space in our psyche because it also draws in these elements of, oh, well, this body has died and this body is no longer the person that it was.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, certainly we've spent the entirety of human history grappling with that. So it's a troubling topic on several different levels.
But I think it's a great topic for this show because it kind of gets to the heart of something that has to, you know, the science of being human, first of all, or of just being alive in the world. As we're going to discover, there are lots of animal necrophiles, and that at the heart of it, this is something that happens on a regular basis, more often than we'd like to think. But that it, you know, I think for cultural reasons that we kind of keep taboo and try not to think about or talk about.
Yeah, except when it happens, and then the media will feast on it as if it is a.
Oh, it's very clickbaity. Yeah, and that is not, again, not why we chose to do this.
All right, so we're going to start off by discussing necrophilia in the animal kingdom. I mean, it generally. That's the way it goes with these things. We can talk about a simpler model of what's going on with the animals before we dare throw in the complications of the human mind and human culture.
And what I was the most shocked about with this as we did the research was how prevalent it is.
Yep.
I mean, we've got at least, what, like 5 or 6 examples of different animals that practice necrophilia today. And I'm sure there are dozens more out there that have just not been cataloged. In fact, as we'll find with the penguin, it was, and then that research was redacted, basically, for culture reasons.
Yeah, it was just too shocking to share. Mm-hmm. But essentially you could sum it all up in a bumper sticker, like necrophilia happens. And,
yes.
And the more you just sort of acclimatize to that reality, the easier going everything else is, that it's not something that is not necessarily an act that is just a defiant before the gods as much as a thing that occurs in the natural order of things, you know, often as an accident, but accidents happen. And then human culture just makes it a little more complicated.
You know what just occurred to me, Robert,
is that
we're assuming that our audience automatically knows what necrophilia is.
That's true, yeah.
So maybe we should just, I mean, throw out a very basic definition, which is, in fact, this was one of the things that surprised me doing the research. In the case of necrophilia, it is not the act of having sex with a dead body, with a corpse. It is the desire to.
Right. Yeah. Just the desire to alone, the fantasy of necrophilia is enough to classify one as a necrophiliac.
Yeah.
And the term itself is actually pretty new. Necrophilia is an entirely 19th century term.
Hmm.
But, of course, the practice it describes, the sexual abuse of corpses, is quite ancient.
We have myths going back as far as human memory, probably.
Yeah, because it gets down to a lot of the key problems of dealing with death. But, of course, you have to sort of define what is sex, too, before we
go forward. Exactly.
Because, of course, human intercourse is essentially the physical act that allows the exchange of genetic information to mix everything around and create a new organism as offspring, right?
Yeah, and that's what makes our first example in sort of the quote-unquote animal world interesting, because it's so alien to how we understand intercourse. It almost seems like it wouldn't be categorized as necrophilia, technically, but it's referred to as such in the literature.
Right, and I'm sure in the science headlines. Maybe not yet, but it's just waiting for the right paper to come out, mm-hmm. and then all the various science blogs will really run with the headline that'll include the phrase, bacterial necrophilia.
Yeah.
Of course, bacteria, they don't actually need to engage in intercourse in order to reproduce. Instead, they tend to swallow up DNA from other bacteria just as they move around, and they'll even absorb it from dead bacterial cells. They exchange new DNA fragments from the dead with their own, and then by shuffling all this around, they're essentially mating with the dead in a way that most higher creatures fail to achieve.
Yeah, the stuff that I read about this in particular, I'm going to be honest, was so dense that I had a hard time understanding it. It seems like it's its own very special niche field that has its own language, and that I don't know necessarily that they're using necrophile or necrophilia sort of in the same way that we understand it when we're applying it, certainly to human beings, mm-hmm. but also to other animals. But it is how it is described in the literature.
Yeah, it is a genetic exchange between the living and the dead.
Yep.
It's almost its own thing because it doesn't really match up with most of the models of biological higher organism necrophilia.
But it's important to include here, especially. I think it's perfect to include at the top. But if you want to move on, we can get into what Robert has coined here as the duck of death.
And I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with this one from the Ig Nobel Prizes, particularly the Ig Nobel Prize for Biology in 2003. Now, just to rehash, the Ig Nobel Prizes, these come out every year.
Yeah, this was new to me, and you explained it to me before the podcast.
Yeah, it's easy to mistake it for like a mockery, mm-hmm. but it's really a celebration of weird science papers and some, you know, science papers that study the strange, or just the weird minutiae that often gets, you know, and is inherently picked up in scientific literature as science expands like a slime mold through the labyrinth of existence.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to pick up some weird topics, and they celebrate these topics. So the 2003 award went to Kees Moeliker, who's a Dutch writer and curator of the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam, and he. Well, he won this paper for his first scientifically recorded case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
Yeah, and before we get into the details here, I want to back up a second because one of the things that I read was that apparently mallards in the Netherlands are particularly known for what are called attempted rape flights.
Okay.
And that this isn't necessarily, From what I was reading, it's not necessarily heterosexual or homosexual. It's just more like these ducks just go for it mm-hmm. while they're flying. And it's somewhat regardless of gender, but 1 in 10 of these attempted rape flights is homosexual in that it's 2 male ducks. And that basically what we're looking at here in this example from Moeliker is that one of the ducks died mid-flight, either from injuries due to their struggle, or maybe it ran into something, and the other duck just landed and kept going.
I laughed a little bit. It's hard not to laugh.
You know what? I think it's okay for you to laugh. I think it's okay for the people listening to laugh. You gotta have a little bit of literal gallows humor with this, in order to get through it.
Yeah, I mean, they are just ducks in this case. Doing what ducks do to each other.
Yeah, and as we're going to find, too, you know, this kind of sexual behavior is fairly common in a lot of animals, birds especially. But, these ducks, it seems like I didn't get the impression because I read the actual account from Moeliker. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he knew how the first duck died. It sounded like maybe it crashed into something.
Yeah.
But basically, there was this duck corpse, and he saw the second duck mount it and begin to peck at it and proceed for quite some time. I mean, he recorded pretty precisely how long everything lasted. And I believe it was like, I don't have it in the notes here, but I want to say it was like 45 or 75 minutes or something like that. So it wasn't like this duck didn't realize what was happening, then realized its, you know, its partner was dead and stopped. It really, you know, made a habit of it.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that the paper won the Ig Nobel Prize and was so that everyone enjoyed it so much, is that it is this meticulous look at this horrible thing that, that, you know, most people might want to turn their eyes away from.
Well, that's the thing about it, right, is that Mulliker sat there and watched this for, let's say, 75 minutes, and I'm assuming with like a pad of paper, and just wrote it all down. And he actually, from what I was reading, it was after that, after the second, I believe that this, there were two instances of it with the same deceased duck. He kind of shooed away the other bird and finally took the corpse of the mallard and, you know, brought it inside. And that other duck hung around, kind of making noises at him for a while afterwards. So it's an interesting case. I would not be the person who would be so intent upon, you know, cataloging this that I would be able to hang out there for 75 minutes. But
yeah,
you know,
it's an example of the unflinching gaze of science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our next case, though, is more of an example of the definitely the flinching.
This guy
gaze
flinched.
Of science.
Yeah, George Murray Levick.
Yeah, he was the medical officer on Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition to the South Pole in 1910. And he recorded the sexual activity of the Adélie penguins in detail, and he was somewhat shocked by much of what he saw. And a lot of this really has to do with him falling into the trap of seeing penguins as little people. You know, they were little people in tuxedos instead of just bipedal birds.
Do you know what this movie, or do you know what this article made me think of? Have you ever seen that movie, March of the Penguins, narrated by Morgan Freeman?
I have not seen any of the various penguin-related movies that have come out.
I saw it, must have been 11 years ago now or something like that, whenever it first came out. I saw it in the theater.
This is the one where they surf, right?
No. This is like a documentary.
Oh, okay.
This isn't the CGI. I think you're thinking of Happy Feet.
Ah, but that came from, what's his name? Director of Mad Max. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right. George Miller.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, anyway, for those of you out there who have seen March of the Penguins, and I think there is a whole kind of genre of documentary film about penguins, one of the things that bothered me about that movie at the time is how much it personified the penguins. Mm-hmm. And clearly, from reading this, like Levick, they must have left some of the more animalistic behaviors of penguins out of the cut so that it fit the sort of humanized narrative that they established, as Morgan Freeman read to us, you know, over this very nice footage of penguins.
Yeah, there's an article that came out on the BBC in 2012 titled "Depraved Sex Acts by Penguins Shock Polar Explorer." And it's a wonderful little read. I'll include a link to it on the landing page for this episode. But there's a quote there. They interviewed Douglas Russell, who's curator of Eggs and Nest at the Natural History Museum. And he says, what is happening here is not in any way analogous to necrophilia in the human context. It is the male seeing the positioning that is causing them to have a sexual reaction. They are not distinguishing between live females who are awaiting congress in the colony and dead penguins from the previous year, which just happen to be in the same position. And so, as the article lays out, George Murray Levick, in writing about these penguins, was so shocked that the stuff about necrophilia, he essentially redacted. Only some of his peers and the individuals that they shared it with were able to read the full unedited account of penguin atrocities.
Yeah, and in fact, like it goes beyond just the necrophilia too. I believe these penguins, similar to the mallards, you know, sort of engage in like a habitualized gang rape is what it sounded like, because there's lots of these male penguins surrounding female penguins. And what ends up happening in these situations is they're so brutal that they accidentally kill the partner.
Yeah. I mean, really, it should come as no surprise, right, that in a brutal environment, creatures will behave brutally in order to survive.
Which leads us to H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, this was I don't know about you, but when I was reading this, I started thinking about At the Mountains of Madness, his 1931 novella which I just reread sometime in the last couple of years, so I guess it's kind of fresh.
It's great. That's one of my favorite Lovecraft pieces. It's a little bit longer than his other ones, but yeah.
Yeah, one of his later works, definitely science fiction. It's it's a work that he conducted a lot of scientific research for. Lovecraft was a guy who, if he were around today, you know, he would be hitting all the science blogs. He would be reading some of the journals. He'd have a subscription to several of the magazines.
He'd probably have a podcast at How Stuff Works.
I would hope so. But he makes several mentions of the penguin, like numerous mentions of penguins, often describing them as grotesque penguins.
Yeah.
And he probably would have read about Levick's thoughts on the penguins. I mean, probably not the unedited content, but he certainly makes reference to Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition in the story.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, in that story, those penguins were somewhat gigantic, right? There was something to do with they were sort of like prehistoric holdover penguins. And we know, I believe, from what I've read in other research instances, that's a thing, that that penguins did used to be considerably larger than they are now.
Yeah, I almost feel like they come off more repellent in that story than, like, the Shoggoths.
So. Oh, yeah. They're terrifying.
So let's move on to reptiles.
Yeah, so we've got a bunch of examples of reptiles in action performing necrophilia. One of the first ones that I found was from an article called, it was published this year, called Corpse Bride Irresistible, a dead female tegu lizard courted by males for 2 days at an urban park in southeastern Brazil. It's very specific, that title.
I love the pull quote on this one from a zoologist who observed this act and process.
Yeah, it's very similar to the mallard duck. Yeah. This guy just sat there and watched it.
Quote, I felt a sense of wonder.
Well, I'll go through this and then we can hit upon some of the other lizards. He provided a very detailed account of what happened here with this tegu lizard. Apparently, it mounted a recently dead female. Mm-hmm. It gained a hold by biting the skin of her neck and attempting to mate with her. The same male just kept biting the neck and rubbing its left hind limbs on her body. And then this basically was like, I think, a 2 day dead female. So it wasn't, you know, as it wasn't similar to the mallard case where it had like just happened. Mm-hmm. Then another smaller male came by and also held the neck of it. And it seems to be, you know, biting seems to be a major part of tegu lizard sex practice, because they just were opening their jaws, kind of biting and putting their mouths around the whole head of this animal. And then after a while, it ceased its attempts. And this is exactly from his figure description. The male tongue flicked the female's head and scratched her hind bodies with the right hind limb. So there you have it. Necrophilia between tegu lizards.
I love, though, about this case. One of the things I love about this case is that the analysis of what's happening here goes deeper than just, oh, it's a stupid animal and it made a stupid mistake and tried to mate with something that it cannot mate with. They point out that, first of all, lizards, of course, cold-blooded creatures. So it's not the creature that it's attempting to have sex with, though dead, you know, it's ambient body heat. Its body heat is essentially going to be that of the ambient air. And pheromones are still going to be in play, even though it's dead. So there are enough signals saying, yes, I'm alive, for the the dominating male to then come in and try and do its thing.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to distinguish here as well, too, is like, consider that these animals are relying on senses that are very different than ours to distinguish what's available and what's alive.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's probably less like, if a human were to go to a bar and try to chat up someone who's just a corpse at the bar.
Just propped up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more like if you're driving down the interstate and you see a sign for a gas station and you pull in to get gas at said gas station, you know, pull the car up, actually get out to fill up, and then realize that the place is closed.
Exactly.
Like the existing signs, the major signs that we care about in this rather simplistic ordeal are saying, yes, we're open for business, when in effect, the lizard is dead.
It's possible this tegu lizard didn't even realize it at all, you know, even afterwards. It sounded like the same with the mallard. Mm-hmm. We've also got this with another reptile, the Amazonian frog. I'm going to have trouble pronouncing this Latin name. Ryanella proboscidea?
Ah, yes. And this one is fabulous. because as a 2013 study reveals, this is functional necrophilia.
Right.
This is something that for pretty much every other organism out there, it's an impossibility. Because necrophilia, we've often discussed this, we've discussed it so far, mm-hmm. In lizards, in birds, it's a mistake that cannot possibly work. But in this frog, in Proboscidea here, our Proboscidea, we actually see reproduction occurring through necrophilia.
Right. So they extract eggs from their dead sexual partners, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they fertilize them. They
right.
don't fertilize them and then extract them.
Right. This is so. How this happened, and it's not not to say they primarily or only reproduce through necrophilia.
Right. Yeah.
But
we should clarify
it's
that
it's on the table as mm-hmm. as a viable option. So the males form a big mating ball that may consist of dozens of frogs, and they're all just ready to go. And then along comes a female, and they essentially all begin fighting on top of her for the rights to mate with her.
Right.
And in some of the cases, she ends up drowning at the bottom of this this mating ball.
Mm.
So it ends up with cases where researchers, particularly in this case, 2013, Thiago Izzo from Brazil's National Institute of Amazonian Research, he's analyzing the results of this breeding.
He finds he's counting.
Yeah, he's counting them like 100 males to 20 dead females in one. In another one, 50 males and 5 dead females.
Yeah.
But then when he starts dissecting the females, there are no eggs. So he's trying to figure out, well, where did the eggs go? How did this, what could have possibly happened?
Mm-hmm.
And then he observed the act itself.
Yeah, and so, like, from what I had read, that there's, this is unique, I believe, to this particular kind of frog.
Yeah.
But that one of the articles that I read on this, which was called "Necrophiliac Behavior in the Kururu Toad," which is a different kind of toad, mm-hmm. but it also references this instance. It says that it's been documented that in all groups of terrestrial tetrapods, that this kind of necrophilia happens, and that basically scientists just account for it as a lack of proper recognition by males during reproductive season. So in this case with the Proboscidea, mm-hmm. it sounds like they do recognize it though, and they say, okay, we've got to take these eggs so that, you know, something actually happens with it.
Yeah, or at least they've reached the point in their evolution to where it still works. So mm-hmm. it's been selected. Because, yeah, what happens is the male squeezes the dead female's body, the eggs pop out, the male quickly fertilizes the eggs, and then they eventually develop into healthy embryos.
So, like, where do they put these eggs while they're fertilizing? They just have, like, a storage area?
I got the impression from reading the paper that they kind of pop out, and it's just done, the deed is done right there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's just, like, the egg is next to the corpse of the female frog.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I guess I was imagining something a little bit more fantastic where these like hundreds
they spirited them away.
Yeah, frogs are bringing these eggs back to their lair.
I believe Izzo did, he did observe, like, in at least one of the cases, the frog moving the body to a location to where he would be able to have his way with it undisturbed by other male frogs.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. But the fascinating thing here is that it's believed that this provides a reproductive advantage to both the desperate outnumbered male who can't get his hands on a live mate, as well as the dead female. Because, even in her case, she's died through this rather brutal breeding process, but she's still going to be able to fulfill the genetic mission.
Yeah, that is the fascinating part. And certainly, it seems like, at least in all the examples that we have here of animals, that reproduction is still the goal, right? Mm-hmm. That's what seems to be going on in the heads of these mallards or these frogs or tengu lizards or penguins or whatever. And it makes me wonder, too, like I said at the top, I'm sure there are many other instances of other animals in the wild that have done this, and humans have probably already documented it. But mm-hmm. like our friend with the penguins, they maybe don't want to get that research. That's not the first paper they're going to submit for publication.
Right. Yeah, I get the impression that it's kind of an understudied area of human behavior, but certainly there's
or animal behavior.
Well, yes, certainly an understudied area of animal behavior, but But there's some interesting work there nonetheless.
So I believe that this frog is a perfect way for us to transition into human necrophiles.
Now, before we get into anything too disturbing, though, we should remind you that, basically, human necrophilia can be achieved in a way that is far less ethically sketchy and horrendous, right, and an affront to the gods, etc. And that is, of course, in the form of posthumous sperm retrieval and posthumous egg retrieval.
Right, which is similar to the frogs that we were just talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Like, basically, it's the frog scenario carried out, far less brutally,
right,
in human culture. The same thing that the frog has evolved to deal with, human technology allows us to do the same thing, to remove a viable sperm or egg from a brain dead or even recently deceased individual and then utilize it in reproduction in a healthy body.
Yeah, I had never heard of this before researching this episode, but it seems perfectly plausible to me, and I could sort of understand the motivation for some people as well.
Yeah, it's almost a disservice to call it refer to it all as necrophilia, because
right,
it's certainly not, an abuse of a body. There are some ethical concerns, and, most of them concern legality and consent of the individual,
mm-hmm,
whose reproductive material is being taken. But at heart, though, it is a reproductive act occurring between a living individual and a dead individual.
Almost like going back to that bacteria.
Right, yeah.
Very similar,
it's
right?
It's very much in line with the bacterial model that we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
And we've had this technology for a little bit. We've been carrying out the posthumous sperm retrieval for a while. And in 2011, we actually saw the first use of effective posthumous egg retrieval. There's a paper with a kind of horrible title that came out 2012,
yeah,
Michigan State Law Review, Dying to Be Mommy, Using Intentional Parenthood as a Proxy for Consent in Posthumous Egg Retrieval Case.
Mm. Yeah, that definitely sounds like something that I've noticed. That's a law article, too, Michigan,
mm-hmm,
State Law Review. It sounds like a case of using a title to kind of make it a little bit more sexy, so it's more attractive to the publishers.
Yeah, it feels a little weird, but at heart, it's a very sensible, procedure to carry out, provided,
sure,
consent is clear and established. You have a sudden death that occurs between two people who want to have offspring, and here is a scientific way of achieving that.
And so, it sounds like this article was specifically about an example in Israel,
yes,
where magistrates set a legal precedent for this, for the harvesting and freezing of a posthumous human being's eggs.
Yeah, and I know some of you are probably wondering, well, how dead can the individual be? Well, I did find some stats on sperm retrieval from a 2006 paper titled "A Posthumous Sperm Retrieval Analysis of Time Interval to Harvest Sperm." And this was published in the journal Human Reproduction. It said, quote, viable sperm is obtainable with PSR, that's posthumous sperm retrieval, well after the currently recommended 24-hour time interval. PSR should be considered up to 36 hours after death following appropriate evaluation. No correlation was found between cause of death and chance for successful sperm retrieval.
So that's sperm in particular, but
right, not
eggs. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I wonder if there's a paper out there that's about the time limits on eggs as well.
Yeah, I wonder if it's about the same or maybe there's a little shorter. I'm not sure.
Mm.
But
if anybody out there knows, please tell us.
Yeah, we'll throw that information in there.
Mm-hmm. So this seems like the moment for us to go down what probably most of you thought you were going to be hearing when you clicked on an episode that had necrophilia in the title.
Which, yeah.
And we're going to call it classic necrophilia.
Indeed.
This is what you think of when you hear that word.
Yeah, and this is, if you want to get off the train at this point, this is your stop. Because it's all human necrophilia from here on.
Yeah, this is where it gets a bit spooky. But not as, I'm going to qualify that. Not as spooky or creepy as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, especially once you crunch the examples that we've gone through already.
Yeah.
It kind of demystifies and, de-horrifies the situation a
mm-hmm.
bit, I find.
Mm-hmm. And there's even some aspects of the human psychology that I don't relate to or identify with, but I can sympathize with somebody, for instance, who misses their dead loved one, which
yes.
seems to be one of the examples. We'll get into that.
Yeah.
But I think what we should really start with is this one paper that came out in 1987, which seems to be cited in all of the research that's done on the psychology of necrophilia. It is called Sexual Attraction to Corpses, A Psychiatric Review of Necrophilia. It was written by Jonathan P. Rossman and Philip J. Resnick. And basically, these guys explored 122 cases of necrophilia. And they found, 88 of them were from world literature and 34 were unpublished cases. Mm-hmm. What I want to know, and I actually downloaded the whole article. I got to go back through and look at the methodology. I don't think they explained it in there, though. Where do you get these cases? It's not, they make it sound like you just go to the library and you're like, yes, I would like all of the world literature cases on necrophilia, please.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing that specified in the paper either. But you know, they had a lot to chew on.
They did. And they used it to basically create some categorizations, some classifications of types of necrophilia, right? So
right.
we've got, and they came up with three.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's sort of a line in the sand that they draw initially between genuine
oh, yes.
necrophilia and pseudo-necrophilia. And mm-hmm. pseudo-necrophilia is, you know, this consists of transient attraction to human corpses, but with these individuals with pseudo-necrophiliacs, sex with a corpse is not the central part of their fantasies. They're
yeah.
primarily interested in living sexual partners, but they're not averse to going after something dead. This group includes sadistic, opportunistic, and transitory cases of necrophilia.
And again, like, let's distinguish here. Necrophilia is the desire to have sex with a dead body,
right.
not the act of having sex with a dead body.
Yeah.
Some of these lead to that, obviously, but some of these necrophilics that they're referring to in the literature didn't act upon their fantasies.
Yeah, like, I could see someone being tricked into being classified as a pseudo-necrophiliac, you know? Like, they have a drink in them, and you're just talking to them and
right,
saying,
just the old
well,
casual.
Would you, and under these circumstances, and then eventually they break and say, well, I don't know, maybe, and then you're...
And then all right, of a sudden you're in a 1989 study on necrophilia.
Yeah.
That's where they got them all. So, okay, the first categorization that they came up with is, I think, what a lot of people think of when they hear the word necrophilia. But they categorize it as a type called necrophilic homicide. So what we're talking about here, this is sort of the Jeffrey Dahmer model.
Right.
Of an individual murders somebody in order to obtain a corpse for their necrophilic fantasies. And from what I was reading about Dahmer, and I mean, that's a whole nother rabbit hole that we could go down
oh,
for
yeah.
another episode. And I think Ted Bundy also partook in this, but mm-hmm. the idea was that those men could not feel sexual pleasure unless their quote unquote partner, it's a terrible word for it in this situation, was dead.
Yeah,
right?
Or at least like dehumanized to a significant degree, because I believe Dahmer tried to create essentially zombies out of individuals by drilling into their skull.
Oh, okay.
But it kind of comes down to the same thing. They needed a person devoid of will.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to achieve that is, of course, to kill the individual.
Yeah. The key here seems to be that what these people are looking for is a partner who is, quote, and this is from the text, unresisting and unrejecting. So I don't know necessarily that it's like, it, maybe it is in some cases that the act of killing sort of sexualizes the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're looking for is somebody who won't reject them and somebody who isn't going to resist them, right?
Yeah. And we'll break down more on the motives for all these cases later.
Yeah. And one fact that I wanted to throw out there that wasn't in these studies but was another study came out was this woman, Michelle Stein from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York.
Mm-hmm.
She reviewed 211 sexual homicides. And she found that only 8% of those involved necrophilia. So when we're talking about, you know, sexual deviancy, sexual crime, and necrophilia, it's actually quite rare. I mean, first of all, these deviant situations are rare. That's why we call them deviant.
Right.
But then also that within that structure, the actual act of sex with a dead body is fairly rare as well within these criminal acts.
Yeah, I mean, you almost can imagine the Venn diagram, right, of the psychotic murderer or relentless murderer, mm-hmm. and the type of individual who would want sexual contact with a dead body.
Yeah, it seems as such, and I think that, yeah, the Venn diagram sliver is probably fairly small. So don't listen to this episode and think, oh my God, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
That's not the case, at least from what the research says.
Now, the next classification under genuine necrophilia is regular necrophilia. Mm-hmm. And this is, I like to think of this as the scavenger approach, entailing the use of an already dead body for sex. So,
yeah.
You know, as we'll explore later, a lot of this happens to line up with one's job. You're in a job mm-hmm. where you're in close contact with dead bodies, and the opportunity simply presents itself.
Yeah, yeah. And I suspect that that is probably the situation, referring back to the sexual homicides and the necrophilia, like, sort of numbers. Mm-hmm. I suspect that this is a bit more common.
Yeah.
Actually, far more common. I think it's extremely rare to have somebody like a Jeffrey Dahmer type. And then the third one that they categorize, and this is 68% of the people that they categorize as necrophiliacs, is necrophilic fantasy. So this is basically, getting back to the pseudo-necrophilia, this mm-hmm. is the idea that it's a fantasy they have of having sex with a corpse, but they don't actually do it. And they sort of think that, and by they I mean the researchers here, think that these necrophiles often choose occupations that will put them in contact with corpses. So, I don't know, working in a morgue or a hospital mm-hmm. or maybe a grave digger. I don't know.
Yeah, hospitals, graves, in some cases, we'll look at some of the stats in a bit. I think like clerics and even soldiers come up.
Is that right?
Basically any kind of profession you can imagine in which you would find yourself in proximity to a dead body.
Mm-hmm. And here's a couple numbers to break this down. 21% of the necrophiles wanted to be reunited with a dead partner. So this is the one that I was saying earlier that I can sort of, not that I would participate in this, like mm-hmm. my wife died or something like that, but I can, I feel emotion for these people who are so saddened by the loss of their life partner that they fantasize. They're not even actually mm-hmm. acting upon it. They're just fantasizing about being reunited with them.
It reminds me of the old Irish ballad that particularly Sinéad O'Connor did a version of this, and also Dead Can Dance did a fabulous version of this. I'm stretched on your grave and will lie there forever.
Oh.
This is about someone who's lost their beloved and they're just lying on their grave.
Yes. Yes. Very maudlin. Sounds quite in line with my experience with Irish folk songs.
Yeah. But it's that kind of attitude. And I think all of us can relate to it on some level.
At least that level of sorrow, I would think. Okay. 15% of them were just attracted to corpses. 12% had a power trip over this, right? So 12% of the people that they looked at saw that they, very much like how we think about, I think, sexual assault, is that it's a power strategy more than it is a sexual motivated crime.
You know, I can't help but, particularly in the whole idea about being attracted to corpses, I can't mm-hmm. help but think of individuals growing up in the age of VHS, you know, mm-hmm. where, you know, nowadays, if someone has access to the internet, they can find just about any example of sexual activity they want.
Sure.
You know, if appropriate supervision isn't there. But when I was growing up, like, the easiest way to see, you know, more kind of adult content mm-hmm. was through horror movies and science fiction movies, you know?
Right.
So, you know, you're not going to go to the video store and rent something, you know, from the adult section, but you can certainly rent Alien, or you can rent Return of the Living Dead, which, of course, has a naked zombie in it. So, uh-huh. like, I wonder to what extent, you know, that's an important time in one's sexual
that
development.
There's a cultural zeitgeist around that's somewhat maybe encourages such fantasies.
I wonder, yeah. Like, I imagine there are a lot of people out there who have their, you know, their sexual development kind of crosses into this horror genre, and then they just sort of burn into their mind various sexy zombies, you know? Like,
and that's been a trope for at least the last couple of years, is the whole zombie thing turned into a boom. I think there was a lot of, like, let's make cash off of this by making the zombies sexy as well. Yeah. So this makes me think of, you know, it's no surprise to the listeners, both Robert and I are big horror fans. I was on Bloody Disgusting. I think it was Bloody Disgusting, which is a, you know, horror fan website the other day. And they had a list of, like, I think it was like the top 10 scenes of necrophilia in horror movies, you know, overall. And I was shocked that there were so many. And then as I kind of went through it, I went, oh, some of these are actually like tasteful movies.
Yeah.
That tasteful horror movies that had, you know, a scene that had to do with the character or the plot. It wasn't just thrown in there to be shocking or to, you know, garner, you know, cult status, I guess.
Yeah, growing up, I remember, not growing up, this was more like college. I remember hearing about Necromantic, I think, as a German film.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like kind of a video nasty classification, you know, banned a lot of places. I never saw it, but it was, it's kind of, I think it's held up there as one of the earlier.
That might have been on the list. I'm trying to remember some of them. I'm sure 120 Days of Sodom was on there. But I've never seen that. Salo.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe. I believe there's necrophilia in that.
I don't remember. I actually saw it in the last year for the first time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because one of our coworkers owns it.
I'm gonna have fun guessing who that is later.
But it's it's an interesting film in that it is highly controversial. But it's artistically well made. It's a work of troubling art.
Yeah,
you know? The director was stabbed to death shortly after it came out.
I didn't know that, really.
And I ended up not watching it in full. Like, I just could not watch a lot of it.
But I never saw it, but I remember when I was in college, I had a girlfriend who was in a film class, and they had assigned Salo as something that they had to watch for class, and she was mortified. I don't think she was able to make it through it. It was, you know, probably part of the class was, or part of the exercise was to see whether or not people could make it through that movie. But, so getting back to the actual, you know, necrophilic fantasies, power trips come into it as you would suspect. And then, you know, as we referred to earlier, the homicidal necrophiliacs, that's again, only 12% of the cases they surveyed. So it's quite a small sliver. Mm-hmm. 12% out of what did these guys, they had 122 cases, and then with the other case, it was out of 211 sexual homicides, it was only 8% that involved necrophilia. Okay, so one last part to this study that they did. They also developed a model to help understand what kind of events led to these, you know, psychological categorizations. Mm-hmm. And this is what they found. They found four. As you would imagine, poor self-esteem, largely due to a significant loss in their life. So that would probably bring us back to the, you know, the 21% who wanted to be reunited with their dead partners. As you would expect, they're usually male, and they're men who have a fear of being rejected by women. And so, as we discussed earlier, they desire a sex object that is incapable of rejecting them. The third is that some of them actually have like a fear of the dead. They're scared of being around dead bodies. And this, like, as a way of conquering that, I suppose, transforms that fear into a desire.
Ah.
Which I think is fairly common transition, not necessarily with dead bodies.
Yeah, I think most people don't experience it on that level.
No, but being afraid of something is also titillating.
Yeah.
You know, is why we watch horror movies. Probably.
Exactly.
And then the last one is just, you know, the fantasy of it sometimes begins after you've just had your first exposure to a corpse, whether that's, you know, as a child or an adult.
Yeah, it's a shocking and it makes an impact on the psyche.
Absolutely. So there's another pretty widely cited study by a guy named, I believe this is pronounced Anil Agrawal. And he published this in 2009. And I believe from what I saw was that this was used to subsequently create a new DSM entry on necrophilia. And his study was called A New Classification for Necrophilia. It was published in the Journal of Forensic and Legal Medicine in 2009. And he came up with 10 categories.
Okay.
We'll go through these.
First up, role players, people who get aroused from pretending their live partner is dead during sexual activity.
Okay. And then we have romantic necrophiliacs. These are these are what we were discussing before, bereaved people who remain attached to their dead lover's body. So they're, you know, this is about sorrow.
Then number three, necrophiliac fantasizers, people who fantasize about necrophilia but never actually have sex with a corpse.
And there's tactile necrophiliacs, people who are aroused by touching or just stroking a corpse without engaging in intercourse. I seem to remember that there was an extremely creepy episode of that TV show Millennium where there was a guy who, that was his particular thing, was just like showing up to funerals and pretending to be a friend of the family just so he could touch the corpse.
Number five is fetishistic necrophiliacs. These are people who remove objects or body parts even from a corpse for sexual purposes, but without engaging in intercourse.
Okay. And the, as you can see, we're kind of, this list is getting worse as we're progressing. Necromutilomaniacs. These are people, I know that sounds like a made up thing, but this is actually,
yeah, it sounds like a band for sure.
People who derive pleasure from mutilating a corpse while masturbating, but not engaging in intercourse.
Okay. Number seven, opportunistic necrophiliacs. These are people who normally have no interest in necrophilia, but if they have the opportunity, they're going to take it.
So, I'm having a really hard time imagining the scenario where this would happen, but mm-hmm. I guess when you're left alone with a dead body for some reason and I don't know. Maybe you're performing an autopsy or something. I'm not sure. Regular necrophiliacs, that's people who preferably, you know, just want to have sex with the dead. So kind of back to that other model that we talked about before.
Like they would even probably tell you, look, I'm not one of those exciting kind of necrophiles. I'm just old school necrophile.
Yeah. And they're, again, they're not killing people, right? Let's be clear about that. That's the next one.
Yeah. Number nine is homicidal necrophiliacs, who we've discussed already. People who want to commit murder in order to have sex with the dead.
And then there is the 10th one, which is exclusive necrophiliacs. People who have an exclusive interest in sex with the dead and cannot perform at all for living partners. Now, this is what I think they categorize Jeffrey Dahmer as, that mm-hmm. like in his case, this was the only way that he could perform, have any kind of sexual gratification, and subsequently led to him both being a homicidal necrophiliac and an exclusive necrophiliac.
Yeah. Now, I have some other stats here just to roll through from that Rossman and Resnick paper, just to give you a little more idea about who necrophiles are and why they do what they do. Sex, 92% in that study were male.
Mm-hmm. And I found one rare female case was cited, and I didn't have the time to be able to look up the case study on this, but her name was Karen Greenlee. Mm-hmm. So apparently she's a well-known female necrophiliac.
Okay. The mean age was 34, which makes sense. You know, you need to be young enough to get around and not have anything tying you down, but also your sexual appetite needs to have had time to reach this point, right?
Right, and also probably you would need to be, you know, as we know about like them taking employment in situations that put them near dead bodies, you would need to be of age in order to kind of have a job like that.
Next up, IQ, and this is really interesting because there has long been and still kind of remains a stereotype of the necrophiles being essentially, you know, mentally deficient, that they're, you know, almost like the example of a stupid reptile that's just engaging with this because they don't know any more better. But in Rossman and Resnick's paper, they point out that all of the individuals that they profiled had IQs above 80, and 69% had IQs above 100. And just to put that in, you know, frame of reference, normal to average intelligence is 90 to 109. So these, for the most part, we're not dealing with unintelligent individuals.
Right.
They're
this
average
isn't,
intelligence.
This isn't technically like a disability, a mental disability.
Right.
This is deviant behavior.
Yeah. And among true necrophiles, 86% had IQs above 100.
Hmm.
64% of the cases, there was a prior history of sadistic acts. Sexual orientation was pretty much comparable to the general population, 79% heterosexual, 13% bisexual, 9% homosexual. Not really surprising. Underlying mental problems. This is interesting because this also gets into the idea that not only this preconceived notion that necrophiles are all going to be both mentally deficient and crazy.
Yeah.
Only 17% were psychotic, 11% among true necrophiles. 50% had personality disorders. 55% had unusual belief systems, though 73% of pseudo-necrophiles did.
Okay.
Which, you know, makes sense if you're fantasizing about sex with the dead, you probably have a different worldview from your average citizen.
Yeah, that's fair. And 80% of those pseudo-necrophiles consumed alcohol, mm-hmm. compared to 44% of true necrophiles.
It's interesting.
So I guess that's just I wonder what they mean by that. If it's like a alcoholism or just a, you know, they didn't imbibe at all.
It kind of, I guess I kind of think of it in terms of, you know, oh, I'm going to need a drink for this. The true necrophiles, you actually don't see as much alcohol consumption because it is like they're kind of enough in the necrophilia camp that there's no need for liquid courage.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's just your fantasy, then maybe it's the kind of thing that you have to decompress to get down to the point where you're fantasizing about it, you know? Mm.
Well, and then 57% of necrophiles were found to be in an employed profession that gave them access to dead bodies. We've got a list here: hospital orderlies, morgue attendants, cemetery employees, funeral parlor workers, and as you said earlier, clerics and soldiers. I found two other studies that I feel like need to be mentioned, but I'm a little dubious of the reporting here. And I'd like to see some more research, or maybe if anybody out there has experience with this kind of research or psychological experience, maybe they can tell us what they think. But these two studies basically connected the symptoms of necrophilia to both autism and Asperger's syndrome. Both these studies came out in 2011. And basically, it seemed like their conclusions were drawn from the fact that there was a similar lack of empathy between those with Asperger's and those who were interested in necrophilia. That was about it. One of these studies said that they suggested something called autistic psychopathy led to experimentation with chemistry, poisons, and killing, which subsequently they kind of tied into necrophilia. And these studies were, the first one is called Necrophilia and Autistic Psychopathy, and the other one is Necrophilia and Serial Killers. Is there evidence for Asperger's syndrome? Hmm. This is published research. I wanted to mention it, but I'm also a little wary of making a connection between these two different kind of mental states just based on the lack of empathy.
Yeah. I mean, there are only two studies, and it's such a hotbed, topic that mm-hmm. I would hate to spend too much time on it. But, you know, hey, if we see more papers come out, maybe we'll come back to it. Now, another interesting thing about necrophilia is when you get into the legal issues involved mm-hmm. here, because, of course, corpses are not really people, right? So these are crimes that often fall through the cracks unless there's a specific necrophilia law on the books. And without such a law in place, it often proves difficult to prosecute necrophiles.
Yeah, and so this is, you know, something that I guess I never thought about and sort of assumed would be on the books, but obviously
it's so rare.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. But there was a case, kind of one of the leading cases was in Wisconsin in 2006. It turned out there was a case where three men were caught while they were trying to exhume a dead woman for sex. The men admitted to it, but another reason they know is that they brought a box of condoms.
I remember this. I think I blogged about
you
this.
You did. That's where I read about it. you were the source for this one for me. But what ended up happening was technically their lawyers argued there was no crime committed because there was no law on the books that said that it was against the law. So this prompted Wisconsin Supreme Court 2 years later in 2008 to finally decide on a law that forbid copulating with the deceased. Hmm. So that's one example. I'm sure there are many other examples, but it's one of those things where I guess like until it actually happens and they need to prosecute, they don't put it on the books.
Yeah. Are you going to be the weird politician who brings up
just
the importance
casually.
Of necrophilia yeah. laws when there's no apparent need?
Right. Yeah, that's going to kill your presidential aspects.
Incidentally, that blog post was one of the first ones I did for How Stuff Works.
Is that right?
Right after we started the blogs, and it was like immediately they had to hide it because they were like, I don't know, there are a lot of eyes on the blog. Let's not have this be one of the top posts.
Oh, that's too bad. I liked it. Well, one of the other things that came out of this when I was looking at the research here is specifically about the legality is many of the families who are involved with incidents like this, where a family member's corpse is a victim of necrophilia, they have a problem with it because they sort of psychologically think of the corpse as being their property, right? So like, as you were saying before, yes, it's not technically a living human being. Some people would probably argue, I wouldn't, that this is a victimless crime, right? But it's not, in that the family members see this as being their loved one and technically property, even though it's not a living person.
Yeah, it kind of comes down to just what a complicated area it occupies in our understanding of our life and our biological life, even, because it's our loved one, but it's not our loved one. It's a person, but it's not really a person still.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said at the beginning too, you know, this is considered to be the ultimate transgression in our culture, one of them, and therefore it's something that we both have a hard time talking about in sort of empirical terms like we're trying to do today, or in legal terms, and then at the same time, it's so sensationalized that we can't seem to stop talking about it whenever it comes up, right? I'm sure if you Googled Wisconsin necrophilia, there's probably 200 newspaper articles out there from 2006 when this happened. You know, everybody was covering it that week.
Yeah, and then yet, when you start thinking about it, it's like if you have a deranged individual, and if they were to, you know, put the question to you, hey, I'm going to do one of two things this weekend. Which should I do? Should I dig up a corpse and copulate with it? Or should I kill somebody?
Right.
You know? Or should I even just assault somebody? Like, obviously you're going to pick the corpse one because it is a, in a sense, it's a victimless crime.
Yeah.
But of course it's not.
I would probably, you know, call the police.
Well, yes, that's the correct answer. You know, even if it's
I'm
a good
covering
friend.
Myself legally here, no matter how good of a friend.
I always, when I think about this topic now, I always come back to Cormac McCarthy's 1973 novel, Child of God, where the central character, Lester Ballard, is a necrophile.
Okay. I haven't read that.
It's exceedingly good. It's one of those books I keep coming back to, because this character's a very dark character, but you're so close to him in the book, you do sympathize with his psyche to a large extent. It's so very well presented.
I think I was trying to think of fictional examples for this episode. The only one I can remember is, do you remember that Marquis de Sade movie that had Jeffrey Rush playing the Marquis de Sade?
I remember when it came out, but I've never seen it in full.
There's, I believe, a scene in that in which Joaquin Phoenix engages in necrophilia with Kate Winslet's corpse.
Huh.
And I think, you know, obviously because it's about the Marquis de Sade, there's a certain amount of bacchanalia to the whole thing, right? But if I remember the plot correctly, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie. I believe it was because, like, he was grieving for her and they were, you know, sort of in love.
Interesting. I should maybe see it at some point. I've read...
I don't remember it being bad.
Yeah. I've read de Sade. I find him to be a fascinating character.
Yeah. I think he's interesting in small doses. I have 120 days of Sodom and I can only read maybe two or three pages at a time.
I tried to read the whole thing. The problem with 120 days is that, it's basically incomplete. And so the further you get into the book, it eventually breaks down into just an outline of what he intended to finish.
Yeah, I think they were originally published as
unreadable
pamphlets. Is that right? Like a series of pamphlets?
I think it's the one that he secretly wrote in a prison cell.
Oh.
So it was hidden away for a while.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But yeah, never officially finished. So it's just in terms, not only is the content often difficult to read, but it becomes increasingly unreadable as a work because it's just incomplete.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's mine. Marquis de Sade and you've got Cormac McCarthy, two of the literary greats.
It's a great book. James Franco made a movie version.
Oh, yeah?
Which I've heard good things about. I'll probably never see it just because it's a book I love so much. I have such a crystal vision.
Yeah, you don't want
it
to kind of mar your imaginary.
Yeah. But I hear good things. So, you know, maybe our, you know, listeners out there who aren't as into reading want to just, you know, see a film, maybe check it out. If it's true to the book, then it does a good job. All right. So there you have it. Necrophilia, a topic, I've been meaning to get to for a little bit here. And, now we have done it. Now it is cataloged.
Yeah. And, you know, like we said throughout the episode, you know, this is a hugely transgressive topic. both to obviously to engage in, but even for us to just talk about. I mean, I think we were a little wary of it, but this seemed like the appropriate venue to do so. So I'm curious out there, you know, what knowledge do you have about this that we missed? You know, let us know, especially like the animal stuff. I swear there's got to be more out there about animals that just is kind of lost, you know? You can contact us where? On social media?
Yeah, I mean, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. I think we'll blow the mind on all of those.
Please write to us on there.
StuffToBlowYourMind.com, the website. And we'll make sure that the landing page for this episode, as with all of our episodes, includes links to related content on the site, as well as links out to some of these key sources we're discussing here.
Definitely, definitely. And if you want to write us directly, if you've got something long that's not going to fit on Twitter or a Facebook message, you can always write us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Whoa.